For more information on Ancient Dragon Zen Gate, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please visit our website.
Thank you very much, and welcome to Joe, whose son attended the Kung Fu Academy that our Shuso runs. And I don't know if anyone else is from that situation online. Nope. So this is the third talk Shuso is going to offer. And just to recap, the Shuso is the head seat, who shares the teaching seat with me during a practice period. So this is a period of 8 weeks for us of intensive practice, and whether you're formally enrolled or not, you are by the virtue that you're here. So Shuso gives three talks. This is the final one, and we're kind of gathering our energy as we move towards Sesshin, which is in 2 weeks, which are 3 days of intensive meditation together. So we kind of have all this engagement with the teachings during the practice period, the teachings of Joko Beck, of Blanche Hartman, and Darlene Cohen, our modern women Zen ancestors. And then we drop into Sesshin in a couple of weeks, just a deep meditation, silence to silent illumination. And but we have almost 2 more weeks to go. So without further ado, but sign up for Sesshin.
Yeah.
It helps our Tenzin and others plan, but we always welcome the last minute folks. I'm not too concerned about that. We always seem to be able to squeeze someone in. So without further ado, our Shuso will speak. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Huketsu. So as we move through these 8 weeks of our practice commitment period, those of us enrolled and those of us that are coming along for the ride, I wanted to take, you know, we're looking at the relationship between teacher and student. We're opening ourselves up to modern women Buddhist teachers and how they brought the Dharma forward in our modern times with modern people. And as we've been very immersed in that, I wanted to use this talk to take a look back. Look back to see this is how it always was. I want to talk about an incident between Emperor Wu, and this happened in China, between Emperor Wu and our first Zen patriarch, our first Zen ancestor, Bodhidharma. So I'll give you a little bit of a background on these two, and then we'll talk about what happened when they first met each other and had a conversation about Zen. Bodhidharma is considered the 28th ancestor or patriarch of Buddhist lineage, the 28th patriarch after the historical Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha. He was also the first patriarch of Zen Buddhism. Zen is Japanese translated into English. Chinese call it Chan Buddhism. So you'll hear these two phrases for what we practice interchanged in English, either Zen or Chan. But he's considered the first patriarch of Zen. He is also considered a manifestation of the Bodhisattva of compassion, Avalokiteshvara. In Japanese, they are known as Kanon. In Chinese, Guanyin. Sometimes Kanzeyan. So again, interchangeable names depending on the culture. But Bodhidharma was believed to be a manifestation of this Bodhisattva. In China, Bodhidharma is often called Dhammo. And in Japan, Dharuma. So if you practice Zen long enough, you're going to hear these interchanging monikers, but you know who is being spoken about. Bodhidharma was a mysterious or mythical figure. Even though there's legends surrounding him, he may or may not have existed. But we definitely know around these stories something happened. Someone's late. So our treasurer, Adrienne Sien, said it just came in. She's my other kung fu practitioner. So we give each other crap like that all the time. But anyway, I was just talking about Bodhidharma being a mythical figure. Maybe he existed, maybe he didn't. But there are a lot of fascinating stories surrounding him. And we know something happened when he came to China. If he didn't exist, something happened around that time. One interesting tidbit about him, another ancestor in our Buddhist lineage, Prajnatara, is believed to have been the instructor of Bodhidharma. Through most of the years, Prajnatara was considered to be a man. But lately, modern scholars believe that Prajnatara was a woman. So we're studying women ancestors, our modern women ancestors, so I thought that was something nice to bring up about the instructor of Bodhidharma. But also, Prajnatara prophesied this to Bodhidharma, that 67 years, this is her quote, or their quote, because we're not really sure, 67 years after my death, you will go to China to present the medicine of the great teaching, showing it directly to those of excellent faculties. Be careful not to go too fast and wither under the sun. And when you get there, don't stay in the south. There they only like fabricated merit, and they don't see the inner reality of Buddhahood. So even if you go there, you shouldn't stay too long. At that time, even though China was a somewhat loosely configured country, there were two kingdoms, one in the south, one in the north, both ruled by different emperors. So it's loosely believed that Bodhidharma did go to China around 527 CE. You're going to see dates that are 10 years after that, 10 years before that. I tend to use this one that I've known the most in my life. Bodhidharma's emphasis was to experience the Dharma, not to read about it, not to intellectualize it, but actually to experience it for yourself. Bodhidharma believed this reality is available for us to know for ourselves, so did Shakyamuni Buddha, experientially through practice. And of course, a big part of our practice is sitting meditation or zazen. This verse is, there's not a lot written by Bodhidharma either, but this four-line verse is attributed to him. That Zen is a special transmission outside the scriptures. No dependency on words and letters, pointing directly to the human mind, seeing into one's nature, and attaining Buddhahood. So that's a little bit about Bodhidharma. Now let's talk about Emperor Wu, the other character in our story. Emperor Wu reigned from 502 to 549 CE in the southern dynasty in China, the Liang dynasty. He has a nickname as the Bodhisattva Emperor because somewhere along the road in his life, he became a devoted Buddhist. It's not sure exactly when that happened, but it is known that by 517 CE, he exerted Buddhist influence on a lot of what was happening in the southern dynasty in China. For example, if there were depictions of bodhisattva or animals on any kind of thing that might deteriorate, he didn't want it used on that, like fabric that might fray, because he felt it was disrespectful to the animals and might attribute to their abuse or disrespectful to the bodhisattvas. There was ancestor worship in China, still is to this day. And if you made offerings to the ancestors, he preferred if people under his kingdom did not use meat. So he came up with all kinds of ways to offer vegetarian offerings to the ancestors. So these are a few of the things that he did. He started building a lot of monasteries and supporting practice for Buddhist monks to go to these monasteries and actually practice. In 527, he actually offered himself in the service of Buddha, and he did this by going to one of the monasteries at Tongtai, and he spent 3 days there, kind of like we do sesshin here. He actually went there, offered himself to the Buddha for service to the Buddha, and stayed there for 3 days. And then he went back to his imperial duties. Then again, a couple of years later, 529 CE, he actually went back to Tongtai Monastery, still in the role as emperor, mind you. This must have been wild for them, right? But this time, he literally let go of his imperial robes. He lived as a monk for 12 days. He did all the tasks that the monks would have to do, work in the kitchen, sweep the floor, participate in the schedule, just like we're told when we do sesshin. And supposedly he was enjoying this practice so much that the imperial offices had to pay a large donation, or what was considered a ransom at that time, to have them send him back to the imperial offices so he could resume his role as emperor. So I want to stress a little bit about Emperor Wu so we understand the gravity of this interaction between him and Bodhidharma. But in the meantime, too, remember, he's building monasteries, he's supporting monks as they go to practice, he's encouraging people to go to these monasteries and practice, he's supporting translation of sutras, he's doing everything he thinks is important for Buddhism to spread in China, at least the Southern Dynasty. Okay, now, what happens? So here we go. Soon after his arrival in China, Bodhidharma was invited to the capital of the Kingdom of Liang to meet Emperor Wu. The emperor asked him what merit he had accrued from his widespread support of Buddhism. And Bodhidharma replied, "No merit." The emperor then asked, "Well, what is the most holy teaching?" We don't use holy a lot nowadays, but maybe what is the most sacred teaching? And Bodhidharma replied, "There is nothing sacred." Now, in that exchange, the emperor did not awaken. Instead, because of his notions of self and others, he asked another question. The emperor asked who it was that was facing him. And Bodhidharma replied, "I don't know." Following this meeting, which obviously didn't go very well, Bodhidharma headed north to the neighboring kingdom of Wei, and where he sat in silent meditation at Shaolin Monastery for what is said to be 9 years, facing the wall in a cave near the monastery. So this little exchange touches on a few things that we still touch upon in our practice that I wanted to look at today as we're exploring it a little bit. But primary, and one of my own personal koans and enjoyment of Buddhist practice, especially the last 5 or 6 years, is really looking at the student-teacher relationship. So even though Emperor Wu and Bodhidharma are technically not student and teacher, we often talk within our practice how everybody we interact with can be a teacher. Everyone we interact with can be a student, just like we ourselves can be a teacher to anybody, and we ourselves can be a student at any given time. So this story itself is looking very closely at the teacher-student relationship and how we don't exist in a vacuum. Even though Bodhidharma went and sat 9 years in the cave on his own, according to Zen and according to Mahayana Buddhism, we don't awaken in a vacuum. We awaken in relationship to each other. One aspect in this conversation, then, that is being taught is the concept of merit. We often don't talk too much about merit and the role it plays in our practice, but gaining merit, because, you know, we don't like to say gaining anything in Buddhist practice, but gaining merit has historically been a part of Buddhist practice since Shakyamuni Buddha, So the emperor asked Bodhidharma what merit he had accrued from his widespread support of Buddhism, and Bodhidharma replied, no merit. Now, the concept of merit is a couple of things. It means that if you do good deeds, you'll have positive incomes in your life. It also means that if you believe in reincarnation or rebirth, doing good deeds now is going to contribute to your next life. So hopefully you'll be born into a more fortuitous position in the world, or wherever, whatever realm you might be born into. And hopefully it's not a hell realm. Okay. But it also points to the interconnectivity of all beings that Buddhism talks about. So for example, if you're someone who has a family and you can't go to the monastery and sit in meditation, if you support people who sit in the monastery, because we're technically all connected, you're actually developing merit for yourself by supporting the person who's sitting in the monastery, because we're actually all the same being. We're actually all connected, even though we have a very distinct Dharma position at any given point in time. So that's kind of wrapped up into this idea of merit at all. When we come as modern people to Zen practice, one of the first things we hear is we don't want to have a gaining attitude toward our practice. Meaning, now, we admit as human beings, we tend to do things because we have some kind of result in mind. It would be silly to say that we don't do that when we know that we do. We were taught that from the womb. But very often, you might be practicing Buddhism for a week, a day, or 3 months. Sooner or later, you're going to hear you should practice without any goals in mind. You should practice without a gaining attitude. You should practice without the idea of gaining merit, in a sense. And then we'll go on to merit some other time, but it's too complicated to talk about in this Dharma talk. So I wanted to look at some of the things that the women ancestors that we're studying, our modern ancestors, say about this gaining attitude. So Joko Beck just opens her book, Everyday Zen, with what practice is not. And Joko literally goes through all kinds of different examples of what goal you might have when you come to practice, or what kind of attribute you think you're going to develop when you practice. And she basically has an argument to shoot them all down, to open your mind. So she gets there right away. Darlene Kohan tells us that it is only in the present moment that you can practice non-preference for the conditions of your life. Non-preference meaning you don't have an idea of what you want your life to be. And she's telling us the only way we can do that is if we completely immerse ourselves in the present moment again and again and again. Blanche Hartman cautions us that any gaining idea implies that just this moment is not complete as it is. So the minute we have a gaining idea, we're removing ourselves from just this moment, and we have a bit of a dissatisfaction with just this moment. Though most of us have a desire to evolve and improve, and yes, we have a desire to do good in the world, setting aside anticipation of what we'll get out of practice plants the first seeds of our awakening. The next concept that's looked at in this conversation between Emperor Wu and Bodhidharma is the concept of emptiness. The emperor then asked, "What is the most holy teaching?" And Bodhidharma replied, "There is nothing holy. There is nothing sacred." Now, we talk about the concept of emptiness, again, quite often as we move through our Zen practice, especially in our chants. In the Heart Sutra, we hear form is emptiness and emptiness is form. When we do the robe chant, we're pointing to a field far beyond form and emptiness. This points to the underlying emptiness of our reality. In this moment, causes and conditions have come together to create this point in time we are experiencing right now. But underlying this point in time, everything is fluid and there is actually nothing to grab onto or attach to. Blanche says in regards to emptiness. We arise fresh in each moment in response to the causes and conditions of each moment, which is why we say each being is empty of some separate continuous entity. There is no fixedness to any of us. We are continually responding to the connectiveness that exists among all of us. Darlene goes on to explain that this emptiness is what gives birth to our not knowing mind. Our not knowing mind. She specifically says, it is difficult for us to live in the realm of not knowing. Just giving everything in front of us our whole attention and suspending our worry about what comes next until it arrives. And then Joko tells us that through Zazen practice, we start to see clearly our habitual behavior and thought patterns, and that as our practice continues and we begin to understand the emptiness and impermanence of these patterns, we can finally abandon them. You know, sometimes it's hard to understand what we're hearing, right, from our teachers or in these dialogues. The other aspect that's pointed to in this dialogue is skillful means. Skillful means. So after being told there's no merit, and after being told there is nothing sacred or holy, the emperor, now I'll put in still, did not awaken, because I'm extrapolating that Bodhidharma is trying to awaken the emperor. Got to read between the lines a little bit. And because of the fact that the emperor did not awaken, he still was hanging on to his notions of self and others. So he asked another question. The emperor asked exactly who it was that was facing him, or basically, you know, who are you? And of course, that's my interpretation of it, that the emperor is somewhat insulted. And he's like, you know, who are you that you could talk to me like this? Doesn't necessarily say that in the text, but I'm reading into that. And Bodhidharma replied, I don't know. So that alone is another teaching on emptiness, or another teaching on not knowing mind, or as Shunryu Suzuki calls it, beginner's mind. And it's a very risky teaching at that. Because again, there is a power dynamic that's imbalanced here. Bodhidharma is in front of the emperor, who at any time could have him arrested and thrown in prison, never to be seen from again, or literally can have him executed for disrespect to the crown. But for Bodhidharma, what approach could possibly penetrate the emperor's delusion and ignorance? Here's a man who probably has a bunch of yes men around him. We even know that in our modern times. Who's brave enough to say something to someone like that who could destroy your life? Such a risky approach, such skillful means, personifies, according to our practice, such compassion. Compassion for this other person. Joko teaches, but compassion as such is simply openness to what is. Since it is absolutely open, it will be receptive and able to see what is best to do and will actually do it. Blanche advises us, in order to make the most skillful response, we need to stay awake and stay present and connected as much as we can in each moment. And then Darlene says, I believe in skillful means, which means I am willing to lie about anything. So Bodhidharma tells Emperor Wu he doesn't know who is facing him. And again, sometimes it can be really hard to accept what is being taught. So following this meeting, Bodhidharma heads north to the neighboring kingdom of Wei, once again, to reiterate. And there he sat in silent meditation, says at Shaolin Monastery, but actually it was a cave very close to the monastery for 9 years. And then there's another story about what happened after that and how finally Zen took hold in China. But that's for another time. Now, after Bodhidharma left And as time went on, Emperor Wu came to realize how mistaken he was in this encounter. And he said he later regretted how he dismissed someone who he was told later was the Mahasattva Avalokiteshvara transmitting the Buddha mind seal. Sorry. I get so emotional at weird parts of these stories. But I'm thinking as a practitioner and someone who has been hard-headed in my own life, how I would have regretted not knowing. Thank goodness for practice now, right? Legend says that Bodhidharma died while he was still in China. I'm probably going to start crying again, but that's okay. When Emperor Wu heard of Bodhidharma's death, he was moved to have something inscribed on his tomb. And you could decide if Bodhidharma's teaching finally broke through to Emperor Wu. The inscription read, "Alas, I saw him without seeing him. I met him without meeting him. I encountered him without encountering him. Now as before, I regret this deeply." He further eulogized him by saying, if your mind now, again, he's talking to us now, everyone, okay? Through time. If your mind exists, you are stuck in the mundane for eternity. If your mind does not exist, you experience wondrous enlightenment instantly. So out of his awakened compassion, what I hope was his awakened compassion, Emperor Wu leaves this teaching with us, so hopefully we could avoid some of the same regret. And so we look back to see this is how it always was. Okay. That's all she wrote. Thank you so much for listening to these wonderful Zen stories we have. And please give us some thoughts, comments, or questions. Hey, Paul.
I'm so glad that you gave Emperor Wu his due. And he often just comes off so bad in these stories.
Yeah.
And he really was an amazing figure. And as you say, a very serious practitioner and person. And anyways, among other things, I was very happy.
You influenced that when we had our discussion about the story of the monk who got his hut burned down. You know how you were saying we don't flesh out what was going on from his perspective and what the patron was also getting out of that relationship. So I'm like, you know what? I'm gonna look a little bit more about Emperor Wu because that was in my mind. So thank you, Paul. Nyozen.
Yes, thank you. Your talks just get better and better. They really do. And,
you have no idea how much time this took me.
Just a lifetime or two. But
I have a question for you. And it's one that it honestly just, it's never arisen for me before in all the years of reading this story. But you sort of framed this talk in broadly in the context of teacher-student. One of the things we hear all the time, you know, we chant it at, you know, here during session and so on and so forth. We talk about the emptiness of giver, receiver, and gift.
Wait, and hold on 1 second, Nielsen. I'm sorry. Can you hear the questions online? They're shaking their head. You need the mic. because they're not going to be able to.
When Douglas had set it there for me, and I apparently didn't.
Okay, all right, you need to hold it to your mouth.
Didn't see
okay.
it. Can people hear
I just,
me now?
I'm sorry, I just realized that you weren't, and I had a feeling that
no,
you were
No, I'm glad
hear.
You caught
and
it.
And it sounds like it's going to be a good one.
I don't get your hopes up.
I want to repeat
But
it.
I've been on the, to all the online people, I apologize, because I've been on that end and know about that. Yeah, just to back up a little bit, I was talking about the, you know, you couched this talk within the framework of teacher-student relationship, and we often talk about, for example, the emptiness of giver, receiver, and gift, and we talk about the mutuality of the relationship between teachers and students. So my question is, after all that, more wind-up than it deserves, but I was asking myself during your talk, well, what might have Bodhidharma taken away from this conversation, these conversations? Did he also learn anything, or do you have any response to that?
I absolutely do.
Great.
He realized that the field wasn't fertile in the South, and there was... Now, I'm, again, extrapolating what I think, right? There is no point, in a sense, using the metaphor to bang his head against the wall. And he went north to the Way Kingdom. And what he learned from that experience, that interaction, there isn't a lot of dialogue when he went north. He said nothing. He stopped talking. And he went and sat down in the cave. So he zigged and he zagged and realized that kind of methodology was not going to work, even though China was said to be ripe for the Dharma. I don't want to say the real Dharma, for the Dharma. The field was ripe. But he understood, and that's probably why supposedly later he wrote Beyond Words and Scripture. But he showed them by example after that. I have to do that all the time, trying to teach a leg raiser to a six-year-old that whatever I'm doing isn't working, and don't get frustrated and don't create a bad experience for that child. Find another way. And sometimes that moment's not the time.
He sounded a little tough and impatient with Emperor Wu, though, you know.
Yeah. Well,
stuck, you know.
Yeah.
I'm not going to talk for 9 years, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's it. Like for me, I am an impatient person, you know? And yeah, that's my... Jerry, who was it that said, what is your personal koan? Was it Hogetsu? Yeah. Remember you asked us last week. Mm-hmm. I think it was on the Thursday, in the Thursday morning talk. Look at what your personal koan, the personal koan you study with in your own life. And Jerry and I had a discussion about that, and for me, it definitely is patience. So,
good morning. I'll just
hi, Nicholas.
Hi. Echo what was just said about your Dharma talks getting better, and it's just so beautiful to see you flourishing in this role. And you know, I've been here for a long time. So it's, yeah, it's just, it's a wonderful thing. Anyway, the student teacher, a lot is said about host and guest. And I wonder if you could elaborate on that. And how is that different from teacher student? And I don't know if you know anything about it. I know very little about it. But if you do know anything about host and guest, could you tell us? Thank you.
Well, the first thing that arises for me, because you said host and guest and teacher and student. So, you know, obviously, I play in the field of teacher and student, so I can more directly answer to that. But I believe that host and guest, the interchangeability of that, would change quite often as the teacher and student dynamic does. But within that dynamic, it is constantly changing. And to say that the teacher is always the teacher has a lot of naivete in it, and it's actually quite the opposite. If we practice in the present moment and we are aware of the changing dynamics constantly within every relationship, through the years, I realized I am more often, I feel, the student. And I think the challenge in the teacher-student relationship is actually knowing, if you could accept that you're more often the student, it's actually knowing through skillful means when it's time for you to play the teacher. But that's all I could say about that. Douglas.
In line with Nyozan, I have a question that's never come up for me before. Am I audible?
Can you hear everybody online?
Okay.
Yeah? Okay.
So, like Nyozan, I have a question that has never come up for me before with this story, and that is, do you think that maybe Emperor Wu was more advanced in his practice than we normally think, and that he was actually challenging Bodhidharma? And maybe Bodhidharma failed, because it's not good enough to say, nope, it's all empty. It's all empty. Forget it. There's no teaching. There's nobody here. I'm out of here. Maybe Bodhidharma figured out that it didn't work, and he went up and sat for 9 more years because he needed to complete his teaching. Where was the teaching of suchness, of the reality mm-hmm. of this right here, everything working together? It's not just, this isn't really a bell. Okay, but what is it then?
Right.
So I think, like Paul, I want to give Emperor Wu his props.
Mm-hmm. There's a Dharma master, a modern one, and I think it's Master Xu something, that has actually a children's book written about Bodhidharma. And he takes that position, and he talks about all the stories of Bodhidharma as he comes to China. And he takes that position that Bodhidharma realized he didn't have the skillful means to break through to the emperor, that in some ways it was a fault of his own, in his own development.
Well, what do you think about a possibility would be that Emperor Wu knew exactly what was going on, and he was testing Bodhidharma, and Bodhidharma failed?
And then Bodhidharma could have failed, and that's why he needed more practice, and he went and sat in the cave for 9 years.
Thank you.
Jerry.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I might take this conversation in a different direction, but I've been thinking about what you said in your first talk about what is the point. And so I was wondering how that sense of why am I doing this? What's the point here? Is somehow connected or not connected to
Nyozen can't hear you in the room.
How is this idea of what am I doing here? What's the point connected to missing the point from a teacher, or feeling like why didn't I listen then? Why didn't I pay attention then?
So the question is, what about missing the point at the time? Like hearing a teaching again and again, and then realizing over the course of time that you just didn't get what you were being taught over and over and over again. But I imagine you're saying at some point you do. Or are you saying you just don't?
Well, if you're going to regret missing it, you must have figured it out.
At some point,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there's a concept of ripening the field of practice. And each individual enters practice. You know, you don't want to say timeline or whatever, but they enter practice at a different point in their personal pollination, let's say. And you can engage with the same text, dialogue, teacher again and again and again. But we know from our Zen practice that there's a lot of variables at play right now that's creating Jerry that I see sitting here. You're not a single strain of reality. You're actually a number of strains of reality coming together in this moment, the Jerry that you are now. As you know, you're not the Jerry you were 40 years ago. So as that reality comes together, there's actually a constantly changing shift in that reality that allows openings at times to hear a teaching. So it's like saying when the field is ripe, you hear the teaching. So you could hear the same phrase again and again and again, and it just means the variables of the host, let's say, wasn't in the right condition to actually hear the teaching. There's a big difference between hearing and listening, and I don't know how like really hearing something, is that called listening or is it called hearing? I think it's listening. Do you know?
Sometimes it's both.
It's both.
I mean, you could say sometimes it's active listening.
So it's like the conditions of our life have to be ripe for us to, we hear the words, but we don't necessarily have the understanding. The conditions of our life have to ripen so that then when we hear the words, it's like a light bulb goes off. Oh, my goodness, I've heard that a million times and I never got it until now. I could tell you something else about that, though. And I don't remember who I was talking to about this. But when you do longer intensives, you know, there's a, like even when we do 3 and 5 day sesshins, there's a clarity you get over the teachings. Like all of a sudden, everything seems so clear. And after you're done with the sesshin or a longer period of practice, like the intensive or something, you just feel, why did I always make it so difficult? And this is so clear and so obvious and all this stuff. And then you go back to your life and literally like in one day's time, you're like, what was that again? Huh? God, it was so clear at the time and I don't understand why. I just don't understand what I learned. So I think that kind of points to that as well, you know.
Thank you.
Okay.
We're so close to time. This has been so wonderful. I'm not sure if there's any last word.
I have one more question. Could you please elaborate on what you were feeling when you got emotional reading the text? I was curious about that.
I have to think back on it. See, I'm so much in the present moment that I actually don't remember. Thank you, Hogetsu, for being such a great teacher.
She means that I never remember what I just said a minute ago.
Hold on 1 second.
Nobody does.
I think you were moved by the regret, maybe?
Yeah. Yeah, when I said Mahasattva Avalokiteshvara, yeah, and I almost start crying when I say the words. See, that's what practice does. Because Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva, there it is the Bodhisattva of compassion. And this is not necessarily the words. This is the gift I have received when people have been compassionate to me, when I was ignorant and I knew no better, the kindness they showed me. And that's why when I even say those words, it softens my heart because of the kindness I have received. And I only hope that Emperor Wu received that kindness as well. And I'm sure he did. I'm sure he did.
Your gratitude.
Exactly. 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 Gratitude. Completely. Through and through. tips of the toes to the ends of the hair, and the fingernails too.
Complete embodiment. Oh, Adrian.
You need the mic.
Yeah, here.
Okay, well, I'm not going to have a profound question or comment. I'm not really a Buddhist practitioner, but I think it's interesting. So I've heard these stories, and it's so nice to hear that how much you guys appreciate Sifu Paula's growth in her Dharma talks, which she's clearly learning through her teachers. But I just kind of want to point out that she's my teacher, and she spreads this message to hundreds of children every day. And a lot of those kids would never experience anything in regard to this kind of practice, myself included. Over the years, I kid you not, we have thousands of children students, and she teaches this to them. And this is actually written into the history of our Kung Fu school that Sifu Paula created. And I just think it's so interesting and so profound to hear this talk today, because you're talking about somebody teaching like thousands of years ago. And I just wanted to say it's really appreciated, and it makes me understand even more what you're passing along. So it's just really appreciated, and I'm glad other people see it. So.
Thank you, Sifu Adrian, and I love you so much.
Love you too.
So this is unsurpassed, profound, and wondrous Dharma, and how it works in our lives together. Aren't we lucky dragons? So, you know, this case one from the Blue Cliff Record, is the famous case that Shuso's comment upon, and Sifu Paula, or Shuso, we'll have a Shuso ceremony where you get to ask her more questions, but maybe this is a good time for us. See, she's ready.
Can't help it. Fierce.
But tenderized after decades of practice. So it takes a little while. But at this moment, maybe we'll move on to the conclusion, and then our anyway, we'll have some announcements, but I really want to thank everyone for bringing forth the fruit of practice together, because, again, this student-teacher thing, this is what we're doing, this dance of the oneness of giver, receiver, and gift, and it's just really precious that we get to share this with each other. So on that note,
we will chant the four.
I think.
Are we going to do an answer?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you can start that.
Okay, we'll chant the four Bodhisattva vows.
Beings are numberless. Lead out to freedom. Illusions are inexhaustible. We vow to cut through them. Dharma gates are boundless. We vow to strengthen them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. We vow to realize it. Beings are numberless. We vow to freedom. Illusions are inexhaustible. We bow to Kapudam. Dharma gates are boundless. We bow to Kapudam. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. We bow to realize it. Beings are numberless. We bow to freedom. Delusions are inexhaustible. We bow. to them. Dharma is our boundless belief.